These time changes can get you very confused. In fact, I've been falling asleep around 5 or 6 every day, so it could be interesting this evening. Anyway, it's good to be back. It was a great trip to Ghana. Everything went extremely well. I had my nephew with me. That was the first time ever. And he really enjoyed it, and we talked a lot about the church. He's had absolutely no church upbringing at all in any church. So this was the first time he'd ever been to church, and I didn't force him at all. In fact, it's interesting the difference in culture, because when I turned up in Kumasi 2 weeks ago, I was going to be speaking at church, and the minister there, he said to me, he says, "What are you doing to make your nephew come to church?" And I just said, look, I said, in our culture, you can't make a 23-year-old do anything at all. Now, in their culture, it's exactly the opposite. If the uncle in Ghana says, you're going to go to church, the 23-year-old will go to church. In fact, even if he's 43, he'll go to church if his uncle tells him to go. But in our culture, it's not like that at all. But, you know, Carl wanted to go to church, and he actually filmed part of the church service. And, you know, he asked a lot of questions afterwards. But even before that, he had been to a Bible study, kept me up till 3 o'clock one night asking questions on various things in the scriptures. So I didn't get much sleep on the trip. But anyway, it was a good trip, and everything went well. You know, in the church there, too, had a couple of days of meetings with the ministers. So very profitable and very successful. Anyway, let's just look at some local announcements first. Before I talk any more about other things, I'd like to first of all just ask you to please continue to pray for Jim Ward. The hospice nurse on Thursday told him and his family that it's only just a matter of a few days until the cancer which he has claims his life. In fact, on Thursday, he was not able to eat anything. He couldn't keep anything down, and I don't think he could on Wednesday either. So, and apparently that's still the case. So this is 4 days now. And, you know, he's just getting progressively weaker. He was really hoping to come and join us today, but was not able to make it. Please do pray for him and also for his family. He's now on constant morphine. Also, Mike Joseph's brother, who's Jim Joseph, passed away last night from liver cancer. So the Josephs are really having a difficult time at this present time. So please pray again about the family in that situation. Then, Bob Wagoner is extremely weak. It's difficult for him to move. The back pain is still very strong. He's gained so much weight that it's hard for him to move at all. His skin is breaking down. So Kay requests that you please pray for God's will to heal him, but if not, to please take him quickly because he's miserable and in quite a bit of pain. So please remember Bob as well. So that's the Josephs, the Wards, and Wagoners at this time. On to another subject, the 4 B's Healthy Eating Program. Is it really 4 B's? Is that right? 4 B's? Okay. Teens will be announced today at the meeting after services. Anyone who would like to give it a try, it's not too late to join. Please be sure to turn in any forms you've completed to the information table. Please be sure to bring any completed forms you have next week, the last week of the month, so we can finalize team totals to find out the first month's winners. So that's from Sharon Fitch about the Healthy Eating Program. Looking ahead to the night to be much observed, for those who would like to go to a restaurant, there is the option of the Golden Rose, which is now called Country House Catering. It's on Okemos Road, just south of 96, so not far from the you know, from the exit that many of you use to come here. There's a meal on offer for all adults. $27 is the grand total, including tax and gratuity, presumably not including wine. Otherwise, the restaurant could easily go broke the way some of you drank. But anyway, the buffet, it's a buffet meal offering beef brisket au jus with pesto mushroom d'Excel. Chicken breast with Michigan cherry sauce, mixed green salad, potato, fresh vegetable, unleavened bread, cheesecake, Non-alcoholic beverage, it does say, is included. $27. A children's menu is offered for $15. Spaghetti, mixed green salad, fresh vegetable, unleavened bread, cheesecake beverage. It is a holy day, so second tithe certainly can be used. So if any of you are interested, there is a sign-up sheet at the information table. Please be sure to sign up today. Please don't forget. Somehow everybody needs to remember, because we do need to get that sign-up sheet done as quickly as possible. There's another announcement here regarding helping people in Haiti, but I'll cover that in my sermon because I'm going to be speaking on a related subject today. So that's it for the night to be much observed. I won't be here for that. I'm going to be accompanying the ABC trip to Turkey. In fact, I'm one of the guides for the trip to Turkey. And in fact, this coming week, I've got to prepare all my notes on that and get ready for it. So that's a two-week trip to Turkey, which overlaps the first day of unleavened bread. And then I get back, I think, the second day of unleavened bread. I did have one or two people ask me about the security on the flight coming back. I was on the flight from Amsterdam to Detroit, which is the flight that the underwear bomber was on. And it struck me as interesting that only a quarter of the seats on this flight were occupied. Now, I would have thought that people would be more logical than that, because logically, that flight is probably the safest flight in the world right now after what almost happened on December 25th. But obviously not everybody thinks that way, and people are trying to avoid the flight. And, you know, it was a pleasant flight because it was almost empty and you could stretch out quite a bit. They are using the body scanners now. And, you know, some people get upset because it's an invasion of privacy. But I saw one editorial in a newspaper. It said, you know, certainly the body scanners are an invasion of privacy because they do focus on the areas you'd rather them not focus on. But those are the areas where it's most easily, you know, male and female can easily hide bombs. But it said surely the greatest invasion of privacy is being blown to bits at 35,000 feet without any warning at all. And I suppose when you look at it that way, you don't worry so much about the other invasion of privacy. So it just depends on how you look at it. Some people get upset about it, but you don't have any choice. You do have to go through the body scanners to be able to get on the plane. You know, one of the joys of going to Ghana is that it's delightful to be able to help people, not just spiritually, but also physically. When we try to help members, we try to help them stand on their own two feet, which I think is, you know, a very good way to approach giving help to anybody, to try to help people to stand on their own two feet. As the old expression goes, you know, instead of giving a guy fish, teach him how to fish. You know, it makes more sense to do that, and then he can take care of himself from that point forward. And, you know, that is the approach that that we've had, Diane and I have had over the years in Ghana, just trying to help people to get to stand on their own two feet in a very difficult environment. To give you some examples of this, there's a couple of young boys in their 20s in Ghana, two brothers, that, you know, we've been trying to help with support from Life Nets, which is the charity that, you know, Vic Kubik and his wife run. With support from them, we've been trying to help them to get through university. Life Nets covers their tuition, so we have to try and find the money to help them with other things, such as accommodation, transport, and food. They come from a very poor background. Their father's always been a struggling subsistence farmer, never had much of an income, never really been able to provide all that well for his family, although they've always been able to, you know, get enough in order to live, enough food, basically. So we've been helping them to get a university education. One of them graduates 18 months from now and one a year after that. So that's just one example of helping people learn to be able to stand on their own two feet, and then also to provide for their families. Because in West Africa, if one member of the family is successful, then he provides for everybody else. He doesn't just take care of himself and his wife and his own children. He takes care of everybody else. So you know, when you can help somebody in a family, then he will take care of everybody else in the family. A few months ago, we were asked to go down to Cincinnati because the ABC students had a fundraiser, and it was quite an evening of entertainment, a very enjoyable evening, actually, that we went down for. They raised over $5,000, and they had already asked if they could use that money to help children in Ghana go to school. Not university students, but children. Ghana basically offers free education to children. However, all families have to come up with the money for school uniforms, which are required. They also have to come up with the money for books, any exercise book or writing book in order for them to take notes at school. There are things like that that they have to raise the money for. Not a great deal of money by our standards, but it's far more than the average family can afford in Ghana. And so they raised over $5,000, and on this trip, I had to find suitable candidates to assist with the children going to school. And when I was in Kumasi, I brought this up with the pastor, and Kumasi is the second biggest city in Ghana. And when I was there, I learned of a lady whose husband died within the last year. She has seven children. And so she was trying to pay for their schooling just by sewing, doing sewing jobs for people, which is, very low income. And so we were able to help all seven children to be able to go to school just for 1 year. Hopefully that gives her a year to adjust after losing her husband. I think he died of malaria or something similar. And then another lady with two children, same thing had happened. The father had died, and so we were able to help those two children. Additionally, three other children from two families whose parents are both out of work. And believe it or not, that's only the total cost of all of those was only just over 4,000 cedis, which means I still have 3,000 cedis left, because $5,000 is roughly 7,000 cedis. So I've still got almost 3,000 left, and when I go down again in a few months' time, I'm sure I'll be able to find some more deserving cases. Then also, before I left, a friend sent me a check to help people. He says, and with it, I was able to help one man start a business selling fish, a man who's been very helpful in serving the local congregation in a place called Kuntanasi. And he had wanted to start a business selling fish, but he needed a freezer, a used freezer, and also needed a generator. And with 1,000 cedis, about $700, he was able to buy both, so I was able to assist him. I helped two others with vehicle needs, which will enable them to support themselves by starting a taxi business. And I helped a man start really the most important business of all, selling beer. And he just needed 2,000 cedis capital to buy the first lot of beer from the brewery. And, as he sells it, then he can put the money aside to buy another supply of beer when it runs out. So I did tell him I needed a commission, and the commission was that he kept me in beer on every visit that I make down to Ghana. So that's going to happen, hopefully. But, helping people like that is a real joy. And I think also it was inspirational for my nephew to see just what a difference a relatively small amount of money can make. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 9. 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7. There's a scripture here, I think, which is very applicable here. It says, "Let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver." And giving in situations like this makes such a big difference to people. Generally, far more so than if you're giving to people here in the United States, where often it is not received in the same way, and it can cause problems sometimes, simply because of cultural differences. But in Ghana, you give, and it makes such a big difference to people and their lives. But what about helping those that God has not called? What about the people in Haiti, for example, victims of a recent earthquake? What should we do to help the people of Haiti? Last night there was a big telethon. I didn't see it, but there was a telethon on television. I have no idea what time it ended. It was expected to go rather late. But it was a big fundraiser to try to get people to contribute to help the people of Haiti. Well, let's look at a passage of Scripture here in Matthew chapter 25, because certainly Jesus Christ gives us a lot to think about in this particular passage, and it's certainly applicable here. And it leads into my sermon subject, which is giving, giving wisely. Initially, I titled the sermon Giving, and then I added the word wisely, because you can give unwisely. And I will come to some examples of that here in the sermon today. But I have seven things for you to consider on this subject of giving. Look at Matthew 25, beginning in verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them, one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and gave you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Then he will also say to those on his left hand, Depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So, you know, clearly from this passage, we are meant to be charitable. And the way that we treat other people is the way that we would treat Jesus Christ, is what Christ is saying here. It reflects on our attitude towards him. So we are meant to be giving. And we're supposed to be giving to the people that are the least of our brethren, and even beyond our brethren, because we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves. So it doesn't just mean helping those in the church, but even beyond the church as well. But let's consider a few things here as we look at this subject of giving wisely. First of all, Ghana... Well, first of all, let's look at bad examples of helping people. Let's get the negative out of the way. So let's look at bad examples of helping people. Ghana is in Africa, but it's not that different from Haiti. I would say Ghana is probably better than Haiti for this reason. Ghana was ruled by Great Britain until 1957. Haiti was an island or half an island, the island of Hispaniola. Haiti was ruled by France until the time of Napoleon, and the slaves outnumbered the rulers by, I think, roughly 10 to 1. So the slaves rebelled while the French were preoccupied during the Napoleonic Wars. And they set up their own republic, the first black republic in the world. So Haiti's had independence for over 200 years. Frankly, to put it bluntly, it missed out on the advantages of 19th and 20th century colonial rule. Because it was during the 19th and 20th centuries, the countries like Britain and France put in a very good foundation. The water and sewage system, for example, roads and electricity and so on, which came during that period of rule. Haiti missed out on that, so probably is less developed than a country like Ghana. I've not been to Haiti. I don't want to go to Haiti, okay? In fact, I remember one minister in the church telling me many years ago, he was responsible for Haiti, and when he got to, on the day that he was about to leave, he got physically ill every time because the country was just so difficult. It is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, the most difficult country for anybody to visit on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. So, even before the earthquake, it was not a pleasure for people to go there. And, keep that in mind. But I've got bad examples from Ghana of helping people. And, I think we can be very naive in the Western world. And television, is very emotional. It shows all these pictures and, gets everybody to contribute. But we still need to think through all the emotion and give wisely, and not be caught up in something which is a tragic emotional event. Having said that, we want to help. So, how do we go about it? So let's look at some bad examples here of giving. When we lived in Ghana, we lived through an 18-month period of famine. And during that period of famine, I remember going into the marketplace to try and find food. It was better for me to go than for Diane to go because it was a dangerous place to go at a time of famine. But I can remember on many occasions seeing bags of rice, great big bags, sacks of rice and wheat for sale. Written on the side of those bags were the words, "Donated by the people of the United States of America, not to be sold." And it was being sold to me for $50 or more per bag. Now, this is what often happens. When governments give aid to other countries, there's a middleman making money in the other country. Now, having said that, when I thought it through, I thought, well, this is what happens. It comes back to the law of supply and demand. The more supply there is of something, the lower the price. So even when it's being donated by another country, the United States or the European Union, those are the two biggest donors, Japan as well is up there. But even when something is being donated and it says on the side, not to be sold, the fact that it is being sold means that there's more of it and therefore the price will come down. Okay, so it's still advantageous. I'm sure the United States factors this in when it gives aid to other countries. But having said that, to be frank again and blunt again, USAID, which organized all this distribution, was known to its employees as USAID, USAID, but many people called it useless aid because it did not achieve what it was meant to achieve. The aid was given specifically to help the poorest people. The poorest people never got it. And there was nothing the U.S. could do about that because you can't go into a country and just take over. There's issues that, would be a problem. I noticed in the papers, I think it was on Sunday or Monday, the United States had taken over the airfield in Haiti, which I think is a good thing because it needs to be run by somebody that's efficient. The Haitians are not very efficient. So the U.S. took over the airfield, which enables planes from all over the world to bring in aid. But the reaction was the U.S. got accused of occupying Haiti. Now, the French were the ones who first accused the U.S. of occupying Haiti, but then some of the locals also took up the same refrain. So, it's a sensitive issue. But when you give help, it's not always appreciated, and it can be misunderstood. So you've got some people thinking the United States wants to annex Haiti as a colony of the United States or as the 51st state or something, and so there are those sensitivities. Here's another example of a bad example of helping people. We had a couple in West Africa who received, this was 25 years ago, when $400 was a lot of money. It's not really much money anymore, but 25 years ago it was quite a lot. But this couple were being sent $400 a month by somebody in the United States who wanted to help them. Well, when you consider that the average income of the country at that time was less than $30 a month, imagine what sending somebody $400 a month did. The man receiving the $400 a month became the biggest real estate owner in his town. because he was using the money, you know, to build homes and then rent them out to people to advance his family. Sending somebody $400 a month, even today in Ghana, when the average income is $40 a month, is the equivalent of sending somebody in the United States $30,000 a month, okay? And we need to understand that. So, you know, imagine what would happen if you started giving somebody in this congregation $30,000 a month. What would that do to that person? Now, I'm sure I could handle it if I was the recipient of it. But not everybody would handle it quite as well, okay? And, of course, if you're giving somebody $30,000 a month, they become the richest person in the community. There's going to be some resentment. There's going to be some jealousy. There's going to be some division, actually. So sending $400 a month to somebody in West Africa is going to lead to those kind of problems. So, again, you've got to think about these things when you're trying to help. You want to give wisely. Giving is wonderful. We've already seen that in 2 Corinthians 9, verse 7. God loves a cheerful giver. And I'm not trying to discourage giving, but I am trying to encourage giving wisely. And not all giving has been wise. And we've often, in the past, as a minister and wife living in West Africa, we've often had to sort out the mess that is created by people giving too wisely. We had one couple, for example, a childless couple who went out to Ghana for the feast, and just made an innocent comment to a family with a lot of children. I said, "Wow, you're a cutie." They said this to the youngest daughter. "You're a cutie. I'd love to take you back to America with me or with us." Next thing you know, the family in Ghana have gone on to the American embassy. They're getting the papers for their daughter to be adopted by the couple in the United States. But, you know, all they've said is, "You're a cutie, I'd love to take you back." You know how innocently you can say those kind of things, right? But the family at the other end took them seriously. And the family also was asking the couple in the United States for financial assistance, which this couple was sending. What the couple in America did not realize is the customs in Ghana are very different. And what was actually happening is really what we would call slavery. The couple in the United States were actually actively buying the child from the couple in Ghana. And the couple in the United States didn't realize what they were doing. The couple at the other end didn't think there was anything wrong with this, because it is very common in West African culture for people to sell their children for personal gain. And in fact, Oprah Winfrey highlighted this on one of her shows 2 or 3 years ago, and highlighted just how this particular couple had sold a small boy. I think he was 5, 6, or 7. It's very common. In fact, we saw an example of this in a town called Elmina in Ghana just last week when my nephew was with me. The fishermen want small boys that they can send down to untangle the nets when the nets get caught up when they're fishing. If they get caught up in the rocks or something. But of course, some of these boys, when they're sent down below the boats, die because they have no idea how to swim. They've never been taught to swim. And Oprah highlighted this on a show, and I don't watch Oprah, but my daughter had seen this and recorded it for me, and I did watch it, and I think some of you watched it too. It's still going on, because we saw this in Elmina just over a week ago. And again, you see, you can give money thinking that what you're doing is the best thing, but you can inadvertently be actually buying a child. And so you're actually caught up, really, in a custom that goes back hundreds of years, known as slavery. Slavery existed in Africa before the white man ever arrived in Africa. And slavery is back again in Africa now that there are no whites in Africa. So it's becoming very common again. So these are bad examples of helping people. And we need to avoid those bad things. Second thing to consider, government-to-government aid is problematic. I really feel the best thing the U.S. is doing is keeping the airport open, enabling food and medical supplies to get in. The more that's available, the more people will be helped. even if somebody is profiting from it, and the chances are that somebody is, because that's the way things work in third world countries. But I will say this, churches have a distinct advantage. They can often get help to those that they work with and to other dependents. When we send help to people in Ghana, for example, we don't only send it to church members. All the family of those church members will benefit from it. So if you've got one person in the church, the way the extended family system works, that one person may be helping 300 people in his extended family, all his brothers, sisters, aunts and uncles, and so on. That's the way it works. The way I run the church in West Africa, in Ghana, with 600 people, it's just like an extended family. And I'm the daddy. I mean, believe it or not, a lot of people call me daddy. Because I'm like the head of the extended family. And that is the most effective way to run a church or any organization, is as an extended family. There are 600 people in my extended family in Ghana, okay? But if we help anybody in the church, then that person helps other people in his family. Our ministers, for example, will help people in their congregations. So the benefits kind of trickle down. And churches have an advantage because I think all churches, it doesn't matter what church it is, are able to be much more effective in getting the aid, the money which is donated in the United States or England or somewhere else, they're much more effective in getting it to the people than governments are. So you might want to keep that in mind. I mean, frankly, I think if you gave the money to the Catholic Church, it probably would do more good than sending it to, a government agency to help the people in Haiti. Now, there may be differences. Haiti may be different to Ghana, but, I can't imagine that it is. And, I've had these conversations with people in Africa over the years. Now, if there's ever a disaster in a country where the church operates, then certainly money will get there. Our people, plus their families and friends, would be helped. And we do have members in Haiti, and I know the church is doing what it can to help those people there, and certainly that is one thing that we can contribute to. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 16. 1 Corinthians 16. Here's an example here of how the church in the apostolic era did help people that were suffering. Now concerning the collection for the saints are the members of the church, and there was a famine in Jerusalem, and the Apostle Paul here was writing to the Corinthians about giving aid to help the members in Jerusalem. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must also do. On the first day of the week, this has been misinterpreted by churches for centuries because they think this is referring to a Sunday church collection. But in actual fact, it was after the Sabbath when Paul was going to be leaving to head out to Jerusalem, if necessary, to take aid to the people. And money wouldn't accomplish anything back then in a famine situation, so they actually had to collect food, which would have been heavy work, loading up the donkeys with all the food. So Paul writes, on the first day of the week, after the Sabbath's over on Sunday morning, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come. And when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem. But if it is fitting that I also go, they will go with me. This may be a reference to the fact that the people would trust Paul more than they might trust somebody else. Because obviously, there's always the temptation for somebody to make some money. But here a collection of food was being taken up in order to send to Jerusalem, which reminds me, I forgot to announce, next week we have the food bank collection, if you could all please remember that. So it won't be going to Jerusalem, though. We may be looking for some way of getting it out to Haiti, but we're looking into that right now. I'm not sure the best way to do that. But this is what the Apostle Paul was talking about here, collecting food to take to Jerusalem. So there's definitely a biblical precedent. And when we know that our members are suffering in some country, and especially when it comes to food supplies, then obviously we do everything that we can to help. And an announcement would be made to that effect, and we would request that people contribute. And certainly there is a need in Haiti, and certainly we can contribute for that too. Point number three, consider this, and I think this is a very important point. It's a very sensitive one, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. Beware of white guilt. Beware of white guilt. Shelby Steele is an African-American writer who's written a book with that title, White Guilt. It's a very good read if you can check out a copy from your library, if your library dare have it in stock. But he claims in his book that white guilt has actually caused a lot of problems. First of all, he says the reason why we can't win in Iraq and Afghanistan is because of white guilt. We won't use the weapons that we can use because innocent people might be killed, and we're not willing to do that, so we hold back. Also, he says, white guilt has destroyed the African-American family. It was white guilt in the 1960s which led to the welfare programs to help single mothers, for example, because a lot of families were poor when, the mom got pregnant outside of marriage. But because the welfare system was started then, it actually made things worse, so that now 9 out of 10 African-American boys do not have a father that they live with to the age of 16. Because now that moms are provided for, well taken care of, then they just kick out the guy, they kick out the father, and so the boys grow up with no fathers. And it's exactly the same in England, by the way. I know of a couple in my family in England where they're living together, and because she's a single mother with a child from a previous relationship, she gets free accommodation and free this and free that. If she marries the guy in my family that would like to marry her, they lose all those freebies. So they have to stay unmarried in order to get the freebies. That's the only way they can survive financially. And all of this, according to Shelby Steele, is due to white guilt. Whites feel guilty for things that have happened in the past. Now, a century ago, if Haiti had had an earthquake, there would have been little response due to a lack of television. TV can take a problem anywhere and influence people's minds by giving it a great deal of attention, or they can ignore it and it receives no attention. Let us compare for a moment Haiti with the world's biggest disaster at the present time. It isn't Haiti. It's a long way from Haiti. It's a country called the Congo. Haiti has lost maybe 200,000 people in this earthquake. The Congo's lost an estimated 5.4 million from a civil war which has been compared to the First World War of 1914-1918, which was the worst war in history. Now, there's some dispute as to exactly how many people have died in the conflict in the Congo. Some say it's only half of 5.4 million, which makes it 2.7 million in the last 3 years. Whichever figure you take, it's an horrendous figure. And is a lot worse than the numbers that have died in the Haitian earthquake. Why is it that the Congo hasn't had a telethon? I mean, why is it that we don't get a lot of focus on our news about the Congo? Well, it's too dangerous for journalists to go there. So nobody will go there. Nobody will cover it. It's rather a primitive country. And a lot of what's happening in the Congo is being caused by the various governments that they've had, and that might not reflect too well on the people in charge, and so we kind of stay away from that too. George Ayate, who's a Ghanaian who now teaches at Georgetown University, wrote in one of his books about Africa, he said, "It is impossible in American academic circles to say anything bad about African leaders." And that's another reason why, the Congo has not been highlighted. There's actually a connection between the Congo and Haiti, and even the problems as a result of this earthquake. You won't hear about this on TV either, but you can read about it in a book written about 25 years ago called and the band played on by Randy Schiltz, who died of AIDS. Randy Schiltz wanted to show just how AIDS spread, how it started and how it spread in those early days. And the title, And the Band Played On, is a criticism of the Reagan administration for not doing anything. Now, personally, I don't see how any administration, no matter who it was, could possibly have stopped the spread of AIDS. But, you know, some people get a bit upset about these things, and he got upset. But in his book, it's well documented how AIDS spread. And he shows it started in the Congo back in the late 1970s. And the Congo, for those of you who have long memories, was ruled by Belgium before 1960. When it got its independence in 1960, it only had, I think it was 9 doctors for a country that is the second biggest in Africa, I think, after the Sudan. So they certainly were short of doctors, and the Congo was broke as a country. Needed doctors desperately, so they needed to find French-speaking doctors who they didn't have to pay much. Well, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. It also speaks French. So they recruited doctors from Haiti. And those doctors went over to the Congo. And around 1980, the Congo had enough of its own doctors and decided to start sending them back. Many of those doctors who were sent back to Haiti had also become HIV positive in the Congo. So they took the HIV virus to Haiti. When they got to Haiti, their pay was so low that they had to supplement their income by providing services to visiting American men who had discovered Haiti was a cheap place to have lots of partners over a weekend. According to the book, it was not uncommon between Friday night and Monday morning for a visiting American to have up to 36 partners that in a weekend in Haiti at about $5 a time. So Haiti lost most of its medical personnel. And you see how now that is contributing to the problem in the earthquake. But you're not going to hear that on any of our liberal media television stations because they don't want to get into that, okay? But you can read about it in the book, And the Band Played On, which probably is still available in your public libraries. So, you know, beware of white guilt, because a lot of this that is presented to you is takes advantage of that. There is a certain guilt, I think, we feel in the Western world because, you know, we are comparatively wealthy compared to the rest of the world. But when you live in the tropics, when you live in a third world country, you realize a lot of the problems that they have in these countries, they bring on themselves through corruption, through bad administration, basically all problems. It doesn't matter where you look, in the United States as well, every country you look at, the problems that exist are due to people breaking the laws of God. That's what it comes down to. And, you know, we break enough of the laws of God in our own country, and we see the negative consequences of that. But in some countries, you can see it much more vividly. You know, I decided to be to take a protective approach to my nephew when he went round the slave castles in Ghana. I didn't want him to be corrupted by some of the things that I said, so I went with him. Actually, that's not really true. I just went with him anyway just to have some time with him. But I went around the slave castles with him, and again, there's a big exploitation of white guilt. So the official tour of the castle will tell you all the terrible things that the whites did when they came to Africa, all the terrible things they did to the slaves. What they don't mention is that slavery was already being practiced before the white man ever arrived. They don't mention that slavery is back. They also don't mention that white slavery was also a major problem at the same time. That a lot of white people were taken as slaves by Arabs in North Africa when people went on British or French or German ships or American ships. This is one of the first problems the United States had when it became an independent country. A lot of people were kidnapped, and they were sold as white slaves to Arabs. It was a major problem. In other words, slavery was pretty much universal. But, you know, they lay this layer of guilt on people when they go around the slave castles to such an extent that when at a time when I was not with Carl on a particular day, a white minister from the United States when they got to the door of no return, the door that the slaves went through before they were taken to the new world, this minister just held up his hand and said, "People," he said, "we, you know, those of us from the United States need to repent right here now," and led everybody in prayer. And Carl got it on film and showed it to me when he got back, and because I hadn't gone to this particular place with him, I went to a different slave castle with him. But anyway, it was interesting. But you see, this guilt is constantly exploited, and you've got to be careful. Because it stops you from thinking straight. The tendency is automatically to give, to help, and to feel bad about things that happened in the past. But we need to look below the surface. The biggest single factor when you think about white guilt is Genesis 12. Genesis 12, this is what it comes back to. Shelby Steele's book, by the way, is a very good read. It's something that anybody of European descent could not have written. But because it's written by somebody of African descent, it adds a great deal to it and adds a lot of credibility to the book. Genesis 12, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing.'" This was a promise to Abraham and his descendants. "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." The descendants of Abraham have been blessed because of Abraham's obedience. And this is, you know, the reason, the basic cause of the guilt that people feel in the West, because we are better off than people are in most parts of the world. But this passage also says, the nations who bless you, I will bless. Nations who curse you, I will curse. Some third world countries have been greatly blessed because they've been, you know, very pro-American, pro-British. They welcome investment from our countries. And Ghana, for example, has picked up considerably since it opened itself up to more investment from the United States and Britain. However, even in Ghana, and this came up in conversation while we were there with Ghanaians, Ghana does not allow any white people to own land. It does not allow it. And it does not allow any white people to own a business by themselves. They must have a Ghanaian partner who must have 51% of the stake in the business. So, for example, if one of you is wanting to start a factory in Ghana producing something, you're the one who has to come up with $1 million to build the factory. But immediately, the Ghanaian, who is your partner, who put nothing into it, immediately owns 510,000 of that 1 million. So what's he going to do the next day? He's going to sell it and take his 510,000. So you see why so little investment goes into some of these countries. And this is the reason why so many are poor. And Haiti has never been a pro-American country or a pro-French country even. It was ruled by the French. That they've always kind of hated them because they were the despised colonialists and the slave traders. But this is one reason why the country is so poor. My personal feeling is if Haiti had been settled by the same Englishmen who settled this country 400 years ago, Haiti would be the prosperous island. And, you know, we might be the poor place, depending on who's settled here. A lot of it comes down to culture. Point number four, charity begins at home. Yesterday, the Lansing State Journal had an editorial that raised my blood pressure. It happens most mornings. And I felt like responding, but I haven't done yet. But in this very long editorial that occupied roughly a third of the page, they suggested, in fact, demanded that Michigan encourage the resettlement of victims of the earthquake in Haiti right here in Michigan. And even though we have got, what, an official unemployment rate of 15% and an unofficial one probably of about 25%, but they wanted Michigan to open up its doors and invite millions of people from Haiti into Michigan. And, you know, it just is not going to help at all. It's not going to solve any problems. And, you know, most people who would come here would not benefit from it. And apart from that, you know, what often happens is when the West takes people from the third world, we take the best people, which makes things even worse in the countries that we take them from. So, for example, we would allow all the doctors in Haiti to resettle here, and that would leave Haiti with no doctors. That's something that really upsets the Ghanaians, because a lot of their nurses and doctors have moved to England and Canada and other countries, and so they're left with nobody there. So it's something for us to consider. Anyway, Acts 17 and verse 26 does say this. This is where Paul is speaking in the midst of the Areopagus. And he says in verse 26 that God has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. You know, it's interesting, you know, when it mentions that there. We forget that. We are big, and since World War II, we've become big into mixing all the different groups from around the world. But, you know, it doesn't work. It's never worked historically. And eventually it's going to explode here, too. But, you know, we overlook what the Word of God says in these areas. But again, the point is charity begins at home. And we should be concerned as well about people here. We've got, 40% of the children in Michigan are receiving food aid. So we've got plenty of people here that are hungry. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So, you know, let's keep that factor in mind. Point number 5, your giving is between you and God. Your giving is between you and God. Matthew 6, verses 1 through 4. Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. So, another good point here on giving. Be careful. If somebody comes to the door collecting for Haitian earthquake victims, firstly determine that it's legitimate, as some will take advantage. This always happens whenever there's a disaster. Some people will come up with false credentials and they'll go door to door or ask you for money in the street or whatever. Once you've established that the credentials are legitimate, I mean, I would always give to a cause like this. I mean, personally, I would always give. However, I would, in giving wisely, I would not be as generous with somebody coming to the door as I would be, say, in giving to the church to help people in Haiti. Because I believe that the money I would give to Cincinnati to help people in Haiti would actually get there and make a difference. The $10 or $20 I would give at the door to any organization, I'm not sure it would. And the bigger the organization, the more I personally would question it. This is just based on my own experience, okay? And, I mean, you can do what you want, obviously. But I would not say no. If somebody's coming to the door and asking for money to help victims of an earthquake, you know, what are they going to think if you say no? You know, you're going to look worse than Scrooge. So, you know, you need to be aware of that. And we want to set an example of giving, but we also want to give wisely. And I would give more to the church to help the people in Haiti. Now, if it turns out, I'm not sure how many members we've got in Haiti. I just came back from Ghana. If we've only got 2 members in Haiti, then obviously you might be wanting to look somewhere else to give more generously. But, you know, just be careful and be aware that, you know, not all this money does actually get to the people that you want it to get to. 2 Corinthians, and I'll be honest here, I mean, sometimes in the past in Ghana, 2 Corinthians, if you turn there, please, to chapter 9, sometimes in the past in Ghana, I will admit that some of the aid that I've taken down there has been lost. I've taken down things that have been stolen out of suitcases at the airport. I've also, on occasion, even had to give something, one or two items, to customs officials to let me take everything else through, for example. So, you know, when I'm taking clothes down, I might have to give a couple of shirts or some pairs of pants or something to customs officials in order for them to let me take the rest through to help church members. This kind of thing happens. You know, I'm not averse to giving people a Bible as a bribe because I figure that, you know, hopefully they'll read it and stop asking for bribes, you know. So, and occasionally, actually, when I've gone through, I've offered them a free subscription to a very valuable magazine. And, you know, they think they're getting something free that's costing a lot of money, but we would have given it to them free anyway. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 5. The Apostle Paul writing, "Therefore I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go to you ahead of time and prepare your generous gift beforehand." Again, this is a collection for the saints. "Which you had previously promised, that it may be ready as a matter of generosity and not as a grudging obligation." We don't want to give it grudgingly. "But this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. So let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver." Always err on the side of generosity. If you're not sure whether what you're doing when you're giving money is really helping, always err on the side of generosity. You don't want to, you know, be miserly and not want to help somebody who is in need. Point number six, just two more left. Use discernment. Use discernment in giving. Matthew 5, verse 42. "Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away." When there's a genuine case of need, you know, be generous. But again, use discernment. I will come to that in a moment. Look at Romans chapter 12, verse 8. "He who exhorts, in exhortation, he who gives with liberality." So give with liberality. Be generous, is what it's saying here. There's lots of verses that tell you to give generously. But let me just say here, one of the things I've noticed when I take people down to Ghana is when they're confronted by beggars, everybody reacts differently. A lot of people feel guilt again, that white guilt that's always there, and they give. Sometimes I give, sometimes I don't, but I always keep something in mind. My nephew actually brought this up. He already knew about this, and he'd never been in Africa before. But he said he had heard that sometimes people deliberately maim their children so that they'll get more money when they beg from Western tourists. Do you want to contribute to that? You know, sometimes that is the case. And even on Ghana television, apparently, one of our members was telling us on Ghana television, they had shown how some of these beggars actually are raking it in. They get far more money than they would if they had a job. Now, having said that, you know, depending on who it is and when they come out to the car, whenever you stop at a traffic light, you'll be surrounded by beggars. You know, maybe not surrounded, but you get two or three beggars come up at the traffic light. They know exactly where they'll get the most money. And, you know, if I've got some coins, I'll give some money. But, you know, you've got to think about these things. Some of those people, especially the children, might have been maimed deliberately in order to get more. Acts chapter 3. Peter and John went up together to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour, and a certain man lame from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms from those who enter the temple. Who, seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked for alms, for help, for financial support. And fixing his eyes on him with John, Peter said, "Look at us." So he gave them his attention, expecting to receive something from them. You know, there's a certain expectation that comes from beggars who, you know, become dependent. There's a dependent mentality. There's an aid mentality as well in Africa. One reason why so little food is produced in Africa is because they know they can get it free from other countries. So why bother? Why work? So, you know, again, we have to think about that. Is giving food aid helping? Personally, I think it isn't. But, you know, we have a whole aid industry in the Western world which employs hundreds of thousands of people. And, of course, they want us to keep on giving so that they stay in their jobs. You know, again, we have to realize that. So, this is a difficult subject. It's not as simple as they make it seem on television. Anyway, Peter said, silver and gold I do not have. So, you know, he wasn't about to give money. I don't know why. I mean, you'd have to think about that. But what I do have, I give you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. So he, leaping up, stood and walked and entered the temple with them, walking, leaping, and praising God. And all the people saw him walking and praising God. Then they knew that it was he who sat begging also at the beautiful gate of the temple, and they were filled with wonder and amazement at what had happened to him. Clearly this man's problem was solved once and for all. We try to do the same thing when we help church members to get on their feet so they can take care of themselves from that point forward. This was somewhat different, of course, as it was a miraculous healing. Point number 7, the final point, realize that many disasters are due to breaking the laws of God, both both natural and spiritual. Earthquakes are unusual in Haiti. Is it possible that it was caused by our damaging the environment in some way? Who knows? I remember after the tsunami 5 years ago, sometime after the tsunami, there was an article by a scientist in some publication I was reading where he claimed that the tsunami happened because so much damage had been done to the coral reefs around the islands by mass tourism. And the reason for the high death toll was because a lot of the tourist resorts had unwisely built accommodation very close to the beach so the tourists could get right out onto the beach. And they should never have done that. And the natives, you know, for centuries never did that. So why did we do that? And sometimes these things are compounded by the mistakes that people make. And certainly that was true in Haiti. In 1995, I was able to visit Hong Kong when it was still under British rule. And I remember when we had a Bible study with the members there, some of the Chinese members expressed concern. They said, well, when China takes over, now these were Chinese people, they said, when China takes over, our biggest concern is our safety. They said, Britain has very high safety standards, but the Chinese do not. So, you know, when they put up buildings, because of all the corruption, the building codes will not be followed. And Hong Kong has typhoons, and some of those skyscrapers can come crashing down, killing hundreds or even thousands of people. That was their big concern. 2 years ago, when China had an earthquake, a lot of children were killed because the schools collapsed on top of the children. And there was a demonstration by some of the parents, and the government quickly cracked down on it. But the parents were accusing the authorities of corruption when it came to putting up school buildings. That the building codes, which probably were minimal anyway, but the building codes were not being followed. And this is the reason the buildings collapse so easily. It's exactly the same in Haiti. They've actually been saying that on some of the news programs, that the building codes have not been followed. And they probably do have low building codes anyway. And some countries don't even have any building codes. But we put up a building in Ghana, and, you know, we know that the standard of what... The standard of workmanship is not all that high. The first house we had in Ghana, we used to joke about it, but we had to turn off the electricity in order to take a bath because the power would go right through the water. It was just kind of scary, but that was the way that some of the houses were built. And, of course, also these countries are lacking in emergency services. Most third world government leaders line their own pockets. There's nothing left to provide emergency services. And that would be true in Ghana, too. I know it would be if they also had an emergency situation. You know, the scripture that always comes to mind the most for me when I witness these things on television or even if I saw them firsthand is in Matthew chapter 6, and we'll close by looking at this one scripture. Matthew chapter 6, it's the Lord's Prayer, beginning in verse 9, "In this manner therefore pray, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Why do I think of that? Because, frankly, these disasters will not end until Jesus Christ returns. The disasters will keep on taking place because man is man, and the mistakes we've made, whether it be putting up buildings that should not have been put up because the standard and the quality is so low, or the corruption that exists amongst so many governments in third world countries, you know, we're going to have more and more of these disasters and the damage we're doing to the environment. You know, these things are not going to change until Jesus Christ returns. And so certainly we should be praying more fervently, your kingdom come. Having said that, yes, we want to do what we can to help. We want to give as we're able to give, but we also want to give wisely. And I hope you'll consider some of the points I've made. As a congregation, there are various ideas. There's one here about a local church in Lansing that's gathering emergency kits for Haiti, which I think would be better than sending money because you really don't know whether the money will actually get there. But the emergency kits, what else can they do with them except help people with them? So this is certainly a better idea. But you know, I will try and find out, and I can email you all as soon as I find out on Monday. I'll try and find out what the situation is with our members in Haiti. Because if we have a lot of members in Haiti and there is a need, you know, that would be an area of priority, I think, to help them. And I know the help would get there and actually be used for those people. If you want to give yourself to another organization, that's up to you. But you know, let us just look into this and see what we can do to help.